This is BraceNetRadio.com. BraceNetRadio.com.
Welcome to Vocal Point on BraceNetRadio.com. Each week, we will examine issues that concern all Christians living in today's culture. Politics, theology, world affairs, citizenship, ethics, and personal responsibility. And now, your host of Vocal Point, Jerry Newcomb on BraceNetRadio.com.
And good afternoon. Boy, we've got a great lineup today. First, we're going to be talking with Dr. Laura Hollis of Notre Dame Law School. By the way, or I guess the business school, the views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Notre Dame, I might add, just real quickly, give a disclaimer. But Laura Hollis writes some great columns that you can see on townhall.com. She wrote one recently about how under Obamacare, we need to remember that we are not subjects and that the president is not a king. In part two of today's program, we'll be talking with a man that was actually the director of the National Endowment for the Arts from 2003 to 2009, and he's asking a question, whatever happened to Catholic and Protestant literature? So it'll be kind of basically a discussion about Christianity and the arts. But let's go ahead, without further ado, and introduce Dr. Laura Hollis. We actually had you on about a year ago, and it was great back then, and it's great to have you back on. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry. I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, now, good. You wrote this column about Obamacare, and I'm sure you got a lot of attention. The subject, the title was, or at least as put in townhall.com, "We Are Not Subjects and Other Observations About Obamacare." What do you mean by that, we're not subjects? He's not a king?
Well, well, you know, we have a long history of rejecting the monarchy, although we're good friends, you know, with the former country. But I think what struck me and what prompted that column was the whole process, not only of enacting Obamacare, but the launch of it, et cetera. And so I was looking at it really through the prism of a number of things. First of all, sort of legislative history, because I also teach entrepreneurship. I have sort of insights into product launches, successful product launches, why they work and when they don't. And then I think, you know, politics and economics, and I pulled all this together, and the whole process has been so appalling from so many respects. And I spent a little bit of time in Boston in late summer, and I had the opportunity to take my children on some of the Freedom Trail up there, and really drives the point home when you're visiting the graves of people like Samuel Adams and James Madison, et cetera, and you think, God, there were people that, you know, they were fighting this battle over 200 years ago, and, you know, you really kind of have to fight it all the time. So when you think back to 2009 when this legislation was originally passed, I think sometimes people forget that, you know, not only did not a single Republican vote for it, but I don't think a single person, member of Congress, ever read the bill. I mean, it was over 2,000 pages. It was dumped on their desks, I don't know, 36 hours, 48 hours before they were supposed to vote on it. And as an attorney, I found that whole thing appalling, that you would vote for a 2,000-page bill without anyone knowing what was in it. And, you know, they were joking about it. I can't remember. It was Charles Rangel, I think, who said, well, even if we'd read it, we wouldn't have understood it.
No.
And I thought, God, how far we've come where, you know, these are our elected representatives and they're passing monumental legislation, you know, taking over one-sixth of the American economy and nobody bothers to read the bill. So that was the first part. And then, of course, you probably remember the town halls in late summer of 2009 when people just packed their congressmen, senators' offices when they were home for the August recess. And then the Tea Party really kind of launched that year, too, had a huge impact on the election in 2010. You know, a lot of people were saying, you know, this is ridiculous. You're not listening to us. So fast forward then to these last few months and the launch of healthcare.gov, $630-plus million spent on a computer program that didn't work, provided no security, and then you look at the details of these programs, insurance policies, millions of people, and again, we're only talking about those that had individual policies. because the employer mandate hasn't kicked in yet. Mm-hmm. So millions of people kicked off their old insurance, put on policies that are more expensive, don't provide the same kind of coverage, don't give them what they want. And, you know, everyone, oh, it's a glitch. It's a glitch. And I thought, no, I mean, you have to look at these things historically. I mean, to my way of thinking, the most significant thing that I said in that November 20th piece was, you know, this isn't a glitch. This is what central planning looks like. Mm. And if you study any of the economic or political initiatives in countries that have done central planning, they are inevitably these big behemoths. They're unwieldy. They're ineffective. They're ridiculously expensive. And that's what prompted me to say, excuse me, this country was founded on different principles. We are not subjects. There's hundreds of millions of us and a relative handful of them. And, you know, it's our country. They work for us. It's incumbent upon us to say, no, this is not what we want.
And what's interesting, too, is you'll notice that a lot of them are exempt. In other words, a lot of the political leaders to this day, I don't know if Obama has actually himself signed up for Obamacare. I think there were the possibility of that last week. But amazingly, some of the politicians that passed this are not signed up for Obamacare. Some of them even said, well, this is too much for our staff to bear. Oh, this reminds me of Animal Farm. You know, some animals are more equal than others.
Right, right. And so, you know, I think that was another one of those sweep of the pen exercises that Obama basically put in subsidies for, you know, congressional members and their staff so that it would make up the difference between what they were used to paying under their old policies and what they're going to pay under the new ones. I mean, you know, when do the rest of us get those kinds of special deals? The answer is we don't.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned the founding fathers. There's the old saying, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance, and that's so true. I think Jefferson said that, but it's a very good point. And I think the other day even it came out that there was a government report complaining about the website provider, and in that report they were explaining how bad Obamacare was, being honest, as the new website provider was coming into being, saying, you know, these are the problems, you need to address these. But that's a very telling document, because even to this day, Kathleen Sebelius will say, oh, we're fine, everything's on track, you know, let's move on, we're, you know, everything's going well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there's no honesty about it at all. And of course, it's very difficult to lie about it when people are spending hours or days trying to log into it, or when they're getting the information and you're saying, what do you mean my premiums are going from $234 a month to $560 a month and my deductible's gone from $2,500 to $6,000? I mean, those are facts.
Yep.
And so I think what they're counting on is, you know, massive widespread inertia, this perception that, well, you know, what can we do about it? It's the law. Well, excuse me, slavery was the law once and prohibition was the law once. We've got a lot of things that have been the law and are no longer the law, and that's why we have elected representatives, and it's important for us to say, no, you know, we need to find a way to provide health care coverage for Americans who, A, don't have it, and B, want it. Because some people don't, mm-hmm. especially young people. You look statistically, they just don't want to spend the money on that without taking over everybody else's health care,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, gouging and most people to provide it free or heavily subsidized for a much smaller group.
Well, in your piece, you mentioned Ted Cruz, and you said Ted Cruz was right, and so was Sarah Palin. I want you to listen to some audio. This is only 30 seconds, but this was a little spot that was made around the time of the holidays saying, thank you, Ted Cruz, at least for speaking up, you know, doing your part. You ready? Listen to this, please.
Millions of Americans have lost their health care plans because of the disastrous Obamacare scheme. One man stepped forward and did everything he could to stop Obamacare before it hurt the American people. Senator Ted Cruz.
I intend to speak in support of defunding Obamacare until I am no longer able to stand.
Critics tried to smear and silence Cruz, calling him
political terrorist, short-sighted, stupid,
arsonist.
Senator Cruz withstood the criticism, showed the courage of his convictions, and stood up for the American people.
When the people rise up,
ultimately, sovereignty resides in one place and one place only in our Constitution. It is with we, the people, to stop that train wreck, that disaster, that nightmare that is Obamacare.
During this holiday season, we, the people, have a simple but important message for Senator Ted Cruz. We say thank you. Paid for and authorized by the Conservative Campaign Committee, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
Now, obviously, the holidays have passed, but I thought that was an interesting message, and it's certainly true. He tried to stop it, and yet I remember listening even to some of our local news stations, and they were saying, oh, this guy is such an idiot. He's such a fool. Here, listen to him. And then they would pot him up, and you'd hear him speaking after, I don't know, maybe 20 hours. And he sounded so coherent, and everything he was saying was right. What do you mean he's a fool? He said, what do you mean? What are you talking about? This is great. And it was all off the cuff, and it was unbelievable. But he was dumped on even by some so-called conservatives.
Well, and I think that's the thing is that, and you know, my personal experience is infinitesimally less than what Senator Cruz is doing. And yet this particular column has gone viral even more than the post-mortem one after the election in 2012, which was, I think, what prompted our first interview.
Right.
And people, you know, universally say the same thing. Two things. One, wow, you're really brave. And two, what do we do? And I think, you know, it's really kind of a sad day when standing up for the principles enshrined in the Constitution is considered brave. But look at Senator Cruz's experience. I mean, within literally days of his filibuster, that computer program rolled out, and it was a disaster, right? And then you have people that are getting all of these notices that they've been thrown off their insurance, and then they're trying to sign up, and they're finding out what it is. And yet, did anybody go back and say, wow, Ted Cruz was right? Did anyone from the mainstream media or some of these other, you know, media installations or some of the politicians that were criticizing him go back and say, golly, maybe we should, you know, give another look at what he was saying? No. So if it's quote unquote brave, it's only because, you know, it seems like there's sort of widespread reluctance to look at the truth or speak it, even when it's staring you in the face.
That's a great point. In fact, one of your points in this article is that the media is responsible. I think that's so true. I mean, let's just take one example. Because we should remember this. This bill was only passed in March of 2010. So we're not even at the fourth anniversary yet of Obamacare passing. And yet, let's remember that there were about 20 or so Democrat holdovers who would not agree to Obamacare until the president made some kind of promise that abortion would not be covered under Obamacare. Well, now we come back, you know, we jump ahead 4 years later, and we see that the president apparently had no reason or had no intention to keep that promise, because we see that the HHS mandate is even mandating that Notre Dame, where you teach, Dr. Laura Hollis, that's my way of saying to anybody who just joined us who I'm talking with. This is Jerry Newcomb, by the way, on GraceNetRadio.com. But anyway, the bottom line is this thing wouldn't have passed if it weren't for the promises about abortion. And if the media was doing its job, it would remind us of these kinds of things. But no, they're not.
That's the last thing that the media is going to remind us of. Yeah,
well,
that's
true.
That's the Bart Spivak vote, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. But, I mean, the media really is responsible for so much of this. And not just this issue, but the Benghazi and NSA spying.
Oh, it's horrific. I mean, it's absolutely horrific. And people are tweeting about it. I mean, I've got a Twitter feed. I follow it. And so in the wake of some of the revelations about what Governor Christie's staff did in New Jersey with the bridge over to Fort Lee, New Jersey, and then, oh, here come the media piling on. I mean, he's their golden boy, right? He's the guy they want to have the Republican nomination in 2016. They're going to queue him up so they can knock him down the same way they did with Bob Dole and John McCain and Mitt Romney, if you remember the primaries. Oh, he was the moderate guy. Then as soon as they have him there, the long knives come out. So, you know, if Chris Christie thinks that these guys are, you know, sucking up to him now and he's going to be their guy and they're going to win all the independents over for him, hopefully this has given him a taste of reality. But because what are they saying? Oh, this is, are his 2016 hopes dead? And I'm thinking, let me see if I get this straight. So a traffic jam is going to kill his presidential hopes, but a terrorist attack on a consulate in Libya that results in four Americans, one of whom is the ambassador, is not going to do anything to dim Hillary's hopes, even though the only explanation we've heard for it is it was a video, which we knew at the time
not
wasn't true.
True.
We certainly know now isn't true. And what difference now does it make? That's the explanation. And none of that is going to dim her aspirations, should she have them, for the presidency in 2016. Now, who is fueling this, right? It's the press. It's the media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Time Magazine and Barbara, 20 most exciting people in the country. Really? You're kidding me.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very true. But it's not just Obamacare. It's so many issues. I mean, yesterday was the anniversary of Roe v. Wade and the amount of deception involved in promoting the abortion agenda. And frankly, Americans are beginning slowly to become more pro-life over time. I think part of the reason is because of things like sonograms. Science is on a collision course with the abortion ethic, but the media doesn't tell us a lot of these things.
That's exactly right. And if you remember, when you and I spoke about this time last year, one of the things that we talked about was this connection between scientific truth and moral truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I don't think, you know, we really give enough attention to or enough play to. I've been tweeting a lot lately in recent days about, you know, abolitionists never gave up and pro-life activists will never give up, because the truth is on our side on that issue. And of course, sonograms and medical technology that pushes back viability, the availability of in utero surgery on children with issues that can be diagnosed and even treated prenatally, such as spina bifida. I mean, you know, people talk about, for example, legislative initiatives, and you'll see the press that'll say, oh my gosh, they're trying to eliminate women's access to quote-unquote reproductive health, meaning abortion. But what nobody really talks about is the diminishing number of an already small group of obstetricians and gynecologists that want to do abortions in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when was the last time you read a statistic about how many of them want to do it? And, of course, you know, one of them said to me, and it may have been quoted, it's been written around a lot of places, I don't want to be in one room, you know, trying everything medically possible to save one, you know, baby's life,
mm-hmm,
and then cross over the hallway, go into the next one, and take one approximately the same age. I'm not going to do it.
Wow. All right, we're talking right now with Dr. Laura Hollis of Notre Dame, and you teach business there? And you're also an attorney, correct?
Yeah, business law and entrepreneurship and courses in those two areas.
Okay, and I understand you. There's a disclaimer here. I mean, your opinions as expressed in townhall.com and so forth, they're your own, so you're not necessarily speaking for the school. But since I'm mentioning Notre Dame, let's talk for a moment about the HHS mandate, because that's a part of Obamacare. And that's very controversial, and many different institutions, not just Catholic ones, but evangelical ones, such as Liberty University, Wheaton College. I met my wife to be at Wheaton Graduate School, which is a part of Wheaton College. So anyways, these different institutions have said, no, we're not going to participate in the HHS mandate, because this includes abortifacients, which is a form of abortion, abortion-inducing drugs. And again, Obamacare would not have passed without the promise that there would be no abortion covered.
So I think there are a number of things to think about and consider with respect to this specific issue. The first is, right, so remember I said when the bill was passed and no one read it, right? So then they get into it after it's passed, right, a la Nancy Pelosi. We have to pass it so you can find out what's in it. And then what we discover is that it gives extraordinarily broad, almost plenary authority to the Secretary of Health and Human Services to write these regulations. So, you know, this isn't a natural function of the bill necessarily. This is something that HHS has decided upon. So that's the first thing, right? In other words, it's not something where you'd have to actually amend the bill in order to do that, although that could be done, certainly. The second thing is that this is such a red herring. It's such a stalking horse because, you know, contraceptives are relatively inexpensive unless, of course, you're talking about, you know, surgical procedures like sterilization and things like that. But most of the, you know, the birth control pill, it's relatively inexpensive for a number of people. It's free. They can go to their local Planned Parenthood and get it. And so the idea that this is the big thing that the Obama administration is going to hang their hat on and force everybody to do. This is their line in the sand. Is absurd, right? I think a lot of people, Catholics and evangelical Protestants, et cetera, Orthodox Jews, were really very surprised by how hard the administration has pressed on this. You know, I'm not in a position to speak for my university. I have absolutely no part of the conversations that the administration has had with our administration, that is, has had with HHS. But the president of the university has released publicly correspondence and, you know, has made no secret about the fact that Notre Dame has requested, you know, accommodation just as other religiously affiliated institutions, educational, healthcare, et cetera, have. And, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, et cetera. And they just have not gotten anything reasonable. So you have religiously affiliated organizations that are pushing this issue. And then you have, you know, the CEOs or owners of private companies like Hobby Lobby and Hercules Industries in Colorado that are saying, wait a second, you're requiring us to do these things, to basically subsidize or pay for these things, which are in violation of our personally held beliefs. Some months ago, I wrote a column on this very subject, and I said, you know, America's schizophrenic about moral business. On the one hand, you see lots and lots of calls for moral decision-making with respect to business issues, whether you're talking about the environment or CEO compensation, outsourcing, treatment of employees, fair wages, et cetera. And so I asked a question in this column, well, where is the source of this morality? Where are these values coming from? For most people, not all, but for most people, this is their religious upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're attempting to run their companies or their departments or put their HR policies in place that are consistent with these values and the way they want to treat people. And so you can't say on the one hand, well, we want you to use your moral values with respect to the environment and employee compensation, et cetera, but, oh, not about these kinds of things, which are in some ways even more fundamental. And finally, I think we have to acknowledge that it's not just about what's going to be considered to be healthcare now, what's going to be mandated now, but you have to look at the confluence of other trends. For example, right, you see in Belgium, they've had euthanasia for a number of years. Most recently, just within the last few weeks, the Belgian parliament has amended the law to now make it legal for children under the age of 18 to request euthanasia. Children will request Skittles for dinner, and we're going to give them the authority to decide whether or not they should die because they're suffering from a terrible illness. So we've got several states that have initiatives like that where they've got legalized physician-assisted suicide. Is that going to be considered mandatory end-of-life care? Because who's going to decide that? It's not going to be Congress, and it's not going to be us. It's going to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services, because she or he is going to have the authority to make those decisions. And it's not abortion today. It's simply drugs that have an abortifacient quality. But will it be abortion, you know, 6 months from now or 2 years from now? You know, so they're thinking down the line. We have to be thinking down the line, too. It's not just about what we object to now. It's the precedent that's being set.
Right.
It's the power that's being given.
And also the issue of freedom of religion. I mean, the First Amendment really was passed in the first driving force for it was to make sure that there would be freedom of religion. And if you look at American history, you see that the right of conscience is extremely important to the founding fathers. And so nobody should be forced to support something that they don't agree with. So the Little Sisters of the Poor or whatever that has an operation in Maryland, these are these nuns dealing with elderly people. Why in the world should they be forced to pay for contraceptives that they don't want to have any part of and it violates their conscience? It's just wrong. It's wrong to do that. And it's wrong to, you know, to ask Jews to eat something that would be against the dietary laws that they choose to do. Same thing with Muslims. It's just wrong to violate people's conscience. And that's, to me, it's very un-American. I think this bill is un-American.
I mean, we've had a long tradition of giving right of conscience, even with things as important as war. I mean, during the draft, you know, we would exempt people, Quakers and others that had legitimate you know, religious claims about pacifistic views. So it's not as if this is unprecedented. To the contrary, as you note, there's a long tradition of it.
Exactly. And it's extremely important. Well, we have just a few minutes left. Please, please, please tell us, what do we do now? What can we do about this?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think one of the most important things, we saw two things happen following the passage of Obamacare. The first was the enormous outcry to congressmen, representatives, and senators when they came home from for their August recesses. And then the formation of the Tea Party. Important enough, we might note, that that has become, you know, the number one issue on the IRS's list, right? So the IRS had met with Obama over 150 times, and we know that, you know, the IRS has held up untold numbers of Tea Party groups' 501c4 status because they did have such an impact. So I think we have to say, look, it's not about whether or not we get tax-exempt status for doing this work. This work has to be done, even if it means, you know, we're paying taxes for, you know, we're going to have to do that. And we have to correspond with our congressmen and with our senators. I don't know if you read about this, but even Dianne Feinstein had over 40,000 calls to her office. And the next thing you know, she was publicly coming out and backpedaling away from, you know, the necessity of pushing through healthcare.gov. And yes, we're going to have to find ways to accommodate people that have been thrown off their insurance. The bottom line is that the pressure works. Mm-hmm. And so we have to actually put pressure on our elected representatives or those running for office and make very clear what we want. And I think what we're looking for is you know, complete repeal. This is going to happen. We're going to have to get rid of this. There's a lot of discussion now. Charles Krauthammer talked about repealing just the two sections of the bill, or of the law, rather, that would, you know, bail out the insurance companies in the event that they're not making enough in premiums to cover what they're paying out. I think that's worthy of investigation, but I'm a little concerned about it, to be honest with you, because my concern is that if those bailout provisions without more are removed and you have insurance company after insurance company that's now going under, that, you know, what's going to keep the federal government coming in and saying, well, we just have to take over the insurance companies then. And now what have we done? We've walked right into their hands and it's single payer.
Right. In other words, socialized medicine.
Yeah.
Welcome
to
Canada.
Now the government is the insurance company.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. No, I agree with you. Obviously, we're all very disappointed with the U.S. Supreme Court. You wonder what happened there. But by the way, speaking of the Supreme Court and the HHS mandate that we discussed earlier, they are going to be taking that issue up later. And that's an interesting thing because actually, I think there have been more than 70 cases so far, court cases related to the HHS mandate. And in 62 of them, I read, the good guys won, which is interesting. I mean, in other words, the HHS mandate was declared unconstitutional to force Notre Dame or, you know, whatever, to force these different institutions against their will. Any final remarks you want to make about Obamacare and fighting it?
The most important thing, I think, I read just a few weeks ago, I don't know if this is true or not, and I don't have the site at my fingertips, but it said only one in five evangelicals registered to vote and or voted in the 2012 election.
Ooh.
Whether that's true or not, it's probably true that a significant number didn't vote. I think, once again, we have to be saying we've got midterm elections coming up. Absolutely everyone you know has to be registered to vote and has to vote. And so every church, synagogue, community group, senior citizens organization, college Republicans, libertarians, whatever, have to make, you know, reach out to everyone and make sure that they get them to the polls.
Right. Very good. Dr. Laura Hollis, thanks so much. Where can people get this piece? I guess just townhall.com and then you can...
Yeah, look for me on townhall.com or they can follow me on Twitter, Laura Hollis 61.
And Hollis is spelled H-O-L-L-I-S. Thanks so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Jerry.
All right, all the best to you. Okay, that's Dr. Laura Hollis of Notre Dame. And when we come back, we'll talk with the former director of the National Endowment for the Arts. We'll talk about Christianity and literature. We'll be back in a moment with more on Vocal Point.